Hello and welcome to the Hi Podcast. My name is Christoph Käse and I have a guest today. His name is Paul Linnemann Larsen. Hi, Paul. Welcome to our podcast.
Hi. Thank you.
You are managing director of Epic Games. You're studio director of Epic Games in Berlin and head of international publishing in EMEA. Epic Games is a prodigy. You are one of your products. The most known product is Fortnite, the game which has taken over the world in a storm. But Epic is doing much, much more. And it's a very amazing company founded by Tim Sweeney, who was born in 1970. And he founded the company in 91 when he was 21 years old. He taught himself programming. And he himself says that he needed thousands of hours of work before he earned his first $20 with his programming skills. And today, millions and millions of people, and the hundreds of million people, are playing Fortnite. There are billions of connections between players. So what is it about Epic Games that makes Epic Games so successful?
Well, that's, I guess, a million-dollar question or a billion-dollar question. I don't think it's one thing. And I think, you know, Fortnite as a success, you know, rests on a bunch of different pillars, to be honest.
Which are, for example, which are the most important pillars?
Well, I think for many, you know, in the game space, I think, you know, a lot of things about timing. It's about, you know, being able to understand what is hot right now, like what is the thing that people seem to be gravitating towards. Which in you know, for Fortnite's case was Battle Royale at that point in time. So being able to recognize that and to execute against that, I think was a core competence of Epic at that point in time. And then I think as a product, you know, Fortnite just hit a sweet spot in terms of finding, you know, huge audience very, very fast. You know, one thing is following the trend. I think another thing is you know, how do you keep that experience fresh and interesting so people keep coming back? I think how do you innovate on that experience without changing, you know, or without jeopardizing kind of the core foundation of what made it great in the beginning? And I think that's the exercise that, you know, most game studios and most publishers, you know, go through on a continuous basis.
And it's also about business model, because one of the big innovations with Epic Games and Fortnite especially is that it's for free. It broke the tradition of the gaming industry that you need to go out and buy, it was a CD in the beginning or some modern data transmitting technology. You needed to buy it, install it on your console, and then you were able to play it. Fortnite is for free. So you just start playing and you make all your money by in-app purchases. If it were an app, you would say in-app purchases, so in-game purchases. So my children are playing Fortnite quite heftily. So they're spending most of their pocket money on stuff that they can buy, on t-shirts, on skins, on weapons. And what I'm amazed with, they're spending money on stuff that doesn't really bring them anything, any like advantage in the game itself. It's cool stuff that they want to be associated with, that they want to see, cool skins. So when did you come up with this idea of giving it away for free, of inviting people to play it for free?
So, you know, I think when you know, launching Fortnite as a free to play, and by the way, this is public information, so I'm not really, you know, disclosing anything secret here, but when we launched it initially, it was bundled with another game experience, you know, Fortnite, which was a co-op player versus environment experience. So initially when we launched Fortnite VR, that was part of that package. So you actually had to buy into the package to get VR, right? I think one of the brilliances of some of the senior management was saying, hey, we think this can be a really big thing. We should make it free to play. And at that point in time, I think free to play to some extent was fairly established, maybe not so much on all the platforms. I mean, you refer to, I'm assuming your kids play on PlayStation, for example, where free to play, you know, has probably had less of was less popular, right? I think the concept of free to play primarily on mobile, but also on PC, was somewhat established that was a really successful way. If you had a runaway product, right, that was the way to go. And I think part of our mantle was always, as you mentioned, is, you know, you buy stuff in Fortnite, for example, and none of that you know, gives you a game advantage, right? It's still 100%. It's a fair game. And what you basically have by buying cosmetics is you have ways to express yourself. You know, it's, you know, some ways, right? I think Fortnite helped bring the concept of fast fashion into you know, digital goods, so to speak.
How many people play and spend nothing at all?
So that I can't tell you. That's I'm not able to share that. But as in all free play titles, there's an amount of players who don't feel the need for spending, and that's totally fine. Like, you know, they are just as important to us as the players who spend. If that makes sense.
Traditionally, there always was a trade-off in gaming. You either had lots of time at hand because you were young, but very little money to spend. So you needed to work your way up. So from level to level, you needed really to exercise skills. But the other part of the community had little time, but more money. So these were maybe people working and playing like occasionally and for fun, 1 hour at night, but it didn't have all the time that the other audience group or the other target group had. So they were able to kind of buy their way up from level to level. Fortnite is different. You can't kind of cheat with money, can't you?
Yeah, you cannot. Money doesn't buy you any sort of advantage, or doesn't leapfrog you ahead of anybody, honestly. You know, it was part of the core philosophy. I think if you looked at free-to-play prior to this, a lot of what you're describing were mechanisms to, you know, motivate people to go and spend money in the game. And I think part of the core ethos from, you know, from Tim and from Epic from the beginning was, this is not how we want to run the game. We want to run a game that's so fun and you know, you're so engaged that it makes you want to spend money, right? Because you know, the offerings we're giving you, the gameplay we're giving you is enough for you to wanting to either support the game or basically buy stuff that makes you enjoy the game more.
The latest number I have on people playing, that you have 350 million accounts, latest number I found. Is this actual number, 350 million accounts?
Yeah, I think that's the latest public number we released.
And the latest public number on earnings was $3 billion. TechCrunch reported on it for 2018 for the entire company. Is that accurate still today?
And given we're a private company, I can't confirm that. I've seen what I will say about some of those numbers. I've seen all sorts of numbers getting thrown out in the public, and it's naturally it's you know you and I are business people, right? So there's a natural thing which is interesting to understand just the size of the phenomena. And I'll say a lot of those numbers are way, way off. So, you know, seeing some of that stuff public, I would take it with a grain of salt. But you know, because the game is as, I would say two things, right? Because the game is, it has as many players as it has. And then second part is because it engages this player base so well over, you know, prolonged time, you know, the business side is doing well. I think our philosophy is if you're having fun, if you're playing a lot of Fortnite, you know, you're also going to spend some money, you know, and you're going to get your friends to play and, you know, they're going to spend some money. So, I, you know, at the end of the day, engagement for us equals monetization, right?
As you said, you're a private company. You have very prominent investors. 2012, Tencent, one of their products, as we all know, is WeChat, invested in you, holding roughly 40%. In 2018, KKR and Vulcan Capital were among others joining you. And in July 2020, so very recently, Sony invested in you and they reported having spent $250 million on 1.4% of the company. So you're a unicorn many, many times over. When Sony invested, Tim Sweeney, the founder, said that Sony and you share the vision of a social 3D experience in real time that leads to a conversion of gaming, film, and music. Is this what's happening? That all these different industries, gaming, film, and music, are converging? Is this how you see the future?
I think there's a lot of truth to that. I think, you know, if I should interpret what Tim is saying, I'm you know, more and more, you know, to me, that sounds more and more like, you know, him talking about the metaverse, right? So this place where, you know, everything exists, you know, in kind of one space, right? And where you have, you know, all these different, you know, access to all these different experiences, and you just seamlessly kind of can jump from one experience to another. And I, you know, watching Ready Player One, I think that was the first time, at least for me, that I saw some sort of visual representation of that could look like, right? And I think in some way or form, that is the path that we're moving towards. But again, there are smarter people who can talk about the metaverse than me. But yes, I agree. I think a lot of these things are converging. I think that the speed of that happening is really hard to predict. I don't think it's going to be, you know, one big bang. It's going to be, as we've seen right now, it's going to be a number of iterations, but fairly significant steps in that, you know, innovation, you know, that will lead us towards the path of that happening.
But it's still, apart from all the technology involved and all the business models involved, it still hinges on storytelling. Your name alludes to that, Epic Games, on storytelling and characters. You have not only put out Fortnite, but you have a franchise in Star Wars. Your technology is being used for The Mandalorian, which totally transformed Disney Plus and really propels Disney Plus into what it seems to be now at the very early stage into a big success. So how important is the storytelling, the narrative part of what you're doing?
I think it's extremely important, right? And I think, you know, it goes hand in hand with technology. And kind of trying to take a step back, I think some of the uniqueness of what, you know, Fortnite was able to do in terms of taking some of these steps, you know, because I agree. I think the application of the Unreal Engine and kind of the technology side is really blowing my mind at a similar level, honestly, as I see the game industry developing as a whole. I think the uniqueness and, you know, of or the interesting part of Fortnite, right, is that for the first time on a scale like this, you see a bunch of different IPs coexist within a virtual space, right?
IP in the sense of intellectual property, right? Not of internet protocols. Okay.
Correct, right? Like, you know, if you told me, you know, 2 or 3 years ago that, you know, in terms of self-realization, right, or in terms of what I wanted to portray, right, I could be a superhero. My friend could be, you know, somebody from Star Wars, and you know, you could be a musician or an artist. It's like that, you know, that wouldn't happen within the same space, right? And that's one of the things where Fortnite, you know, have found a way to make all these things coexist and create real win-win opportunities, both for you know, for Epic and Fortnite, but also for the artists involved or the IP owners involved. I think that's a real step again towards, you know, realizing the metaverse.
That is very interesting what you're saying. Let's look at one example. Marvel Avengers is one of the games you're putting out, one of the franchises you cater to. When you think about it, Marvel was a comic company, a print company. They went into movie production very, very successfully, totally transformed their company from a print company to an audiovisual entertainment company. Then they were acquired by Disney. It's now intellectual property of Disney. You now have Sony as one of your investors. So we are looking at a print publishing Marvel characters acquired by Disney, appearing in a game co-owned by Sony. This would have been pretty unthinkable 20 years ago. So the metaverse is also a universe where kind of rights coexist in a new type of environment.
Yes, and where everybody benefits from that, right? And I think one of the things that, you know, from a personal perspective, you know, not talking as being employed at Epic, but one of the things that really impressed me was, you know, Tim's strong push for crossplay. Because that's another example of where for this metaverse to happen, you have to break down barriers between platforms. You have to make sure that social systems aren't interrupted, you know, by, you know, you being on Sony PlayStation and I'm playing on a Microsoft Xbox, right? So there's been some important steps towards making that happen. And then as you say, yes, I mean that a lot of these things were unthinkable, right? You know, we have IP from the two biggest, you know, comic universes, and they can technically coexist side by side, right? And that's unique, but it's only possible because everybody benefits. It's, you know, everybody, it's a win-win situation.
And There was much writing about what will happen to the business of consoles as such. There's saying that the newest generation of consoles coming out now might be the last because they might disappear altogether, making way for streamed games only. So will my kids need to buy a console in 5 years from now, or will it be in one metaverse platform combining all the different systems?
Right. I think that's one of the interesting things that also happened, you know, this or I guess it's really started last year when Stadia was announced. That's a good question. I view it a little bit as when people talk about the PC as a game device, you know, would cease to exist. And everybody's just, you know, for many, many years talked about how, you know, PC is going to be less and less relevant. And actually PC as a gaming platform has increased, has grown, right? So I think people are quick to write certain things off. I wouldn't be surprised if we, you know, come, so this generation that's coming out in Christmas, I think most of it's going to run out and buy it because it seems to be an incredibly powerful gaming platform. However, you know, for the next generation, I wouldn't be surprised if we don't, right? But I would also not be super surprised if we do. I think that really depends on how well this cloud-based streaming is able to take off. And I think with Stadia, we've seen it's not as easy as people might allude to, or at least for certain types of games. And if we look at what type of games has a challenge right now to go into the cloud, those are, you know, your large free-to-play player versus player type of game experiences. So I think until some of those challenges are solved, you won't really see a move away from you know, your PlayStations or Nintendos or Xboxes.
It's an interesting perspective. Much as with other forms of media, whenever a new form of medium arises, there's always talk that old ones will die. It almost never happened in history. Radio wasn't killed by television. It was augmented by television. Now, looking at everything that you're doing, these huge games, these very complicated IP construction, one might think when I first looked at Epic, I kind of figured you must have like 2,000, 3,000 employees. When I looked at the numbers, I was quite astonished reading that you're just 200 people, in the ballpark of 200 people. There was some criticism in the press that your people are absolutely working at their outer limit, like putting in like shifts of like 70 to 100 hours a week. You have tried to counter this, but it seems like you're very, very stretched at this point in time, like taken hostage by your own success. How are you trying to counter this with a relatively small company handling this huge growth?
So just to correct the numbers, we are around 2,000 people globally at Epic.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I think that the challenge that you mentioned is real, right? Like, I think, so a couple of things. I think as an industry, I think we just have a challenge in terms of how the work norms have been for many, many years, right? I think the challenge that you're seeing now is when you run games as a service, which means they're always on, right? And one of the key competitive parameters are how fast can you create content and get it to the players, right? Because it's this maintaining engagement, growing engagement is such a key part of what makes your game successful. I think that just inherently puts pressure on everyone, right? Because beforehand, you know, you would work really intensely on a product and you will ship it, and then you would get somewhat of a breather. But with games as a service, like, you don't have those breathers. I think we at Epic have tried to tackle that in a number of ways. So one of the things we do, and I think that's very admirable, is, you know, when it comes to summer and Christmas, we have periods of time where the entire office really goes, like, shuts down. So everybody can go away. You know, there's no emails. You know, it's you know, that to me, that's a powerful way to, and it's just one step of what we're trying to do in terms of tackling the challenges of, you know, there's a lot of work associated with, as you said, running the biggest game in the world and all the other stuff we do, by the way, you know, which enables this to happen.
Let's talk about creativity for a moment. The gaming industry is known for its hit business character, almost like in books or movies. Hit businesses are great when you have a hit, but they are terrible when you just had a hit and you scaled the company, as we were just talking about, to cater to that hit, but then all of a sudden you don't have a hit anymore. So it's a risky investment, as seen by investors many times, because what comes next? And things can go out of fashion pretty quickly. So how do you handle the creativity problem?
I think that's very true. I think where that is changing a little bit is because it's games as a service. So when you reach these kind of scales, it doesn't necessarily go away overnight. I think it's a real thing, right? I look to, for one of my former employers, Riot Games, right? Which now, if you look this year, and I think last year, it really started to actually, release games, as a follow-up to League of Legends, right? That was, I think, the biggest PC game in history. It's not easy. I do think the nature of how we operate, again, games as a service, prolongs, that S-curve and makes the transition at least smoother than it otherwise would be. I don't know if that really answers your question.
Well, it does answer the question. And one can see that you're trying to prolong the life by introducing new ideas and new forms of entertainment into what you're doing. What I'm talking about specifically is Party Royale, where within the game, there is a new social experience. It's a party. And you as a gamer can join the party as your avatar and be part of the party. And you invite big names like Travis Scott or Dylan Francis to be in the party. So you can attend a party with some of the stars you admire and be part of the thing. So it's not about gaming. It's not hit and run. It's not shooting anymore. It is taking part in a virtual party. So this might be you're kind of piggybacking, right? The one model on the back of the other and try to give it a lift before the other one dies out.
Well, I think I would frame it differently. I would say I think in many ways, right? Like, and it's a big word to use, and I don't know if that's correct at this point in time, right? But I think, viewing Fortnite more as a platform, right? Platform of experiences, instead of just a game, right? Which is a product that has a certain S-curve. I think, you mentioned Party Royale. I think a lot of the stuff we're doing, whether it's a Travis Scott concert or, even when we've shown, video content, long form video content, the idea that you can get different types of experience within that universe, right? Like, I don't play VR, but I will go and watch Travis Scott concert with my daughter. So I think the idea, and that ties back to UGC, right? Which is the creative mode, which is another big part of Fortnite where people can come in and create new experiences, that they then can serve up to an existing audience that's really, really large, right? Because I think a lot of the innovation, both if we look to the last 10 years, but also going forward, a lot of the true innovation won't come out of AAA studios. It's going to come out of user-generated content in some way or form, right? So creative mode for us is, hey, if you're going to create the next best thing, go create it in Fortnite, right? You have tools, you have an audience. And that, again, for us is another win-win situation.
You are in a very thriving industry. Most experts are expecting the worldwide gaming industry to hit the $2 billion per year sales benchmark very soon, in a couple of years. And the prospective growth is roughly 10% per year. So before COVID, the airline industry used to grow with, if I remember correctly, roughly 5% per year. So you double the growth rate of Corona, and Corona is probably not hurting you, but rather benefiting you because people are stuck at home and want to have some experiences, even if they're virtual. So do you foresee any kind of slowing of growth in that industry, or are we going to see more of that for the next 10, 15 years?
I would put it like this. I don't see why we wouldn't see double-digit growth in this industry, right? As you mentioned before, a lot of other industry, there's a convergence happens on top, and I think it's going to benefit, all of those industries. And I think, not too many years ago, gaming as a group, surpassed film and music together. And I think now people are starting to recognize that potential and starting to pay attention. I would be bullish on the gaming industry, and a lot of the supporting industries, whether it's esports or tech that supports tech or services that supports the game industry, because I think, back in the days, if you were a gamer, you know, you were a niche, right? You met another gamer and you were super excited, right? Today, everybody's gamers, right? I think there's like close to 3 billion people who play video games on a regular basis, right? Out of an eight billion population, right? Like gaming is mainstream. And I think that's the realization that, you know, as, you know, the younger generations, they grow up, gaming is as a natural part of them as, you know, you and I would go and play sports, right? Gaming is as natural part of their identity and their day-to-day, you know, entertainment. So yes, I would stay very bullish on gaming as an industry.
Okay. Would there be a difference between esports and gaming? To me, I do real sports. I have never found, you know, the passion and excitement with esports, but I know people who do. What's the difference between gaming and esports?
I think there's a lot of differences, right? I think gaming as an industry is mature, right? I think esports is about set to take off. But I think that, you know, at the overarching challenge for esports, and that's a huge topic in its own, so I won't get into that. But I think overall, I think the challenge with esports is it has yet to find what is the dominating business model, right? I think there's a lot of investor money flowing into esports. I think there's a lot of eyeballs on esports. Like, you know, Twitch just reported 5 billion hours watched their last quarter, which is up 50, 60% the quarter before, right? So it's huge. But because people tend to treat it, at least a lot of them from outside, treat it and think about it like traditional sports, they're missing a couple of key components there, which one of them is the business model is just inherently very, very different from traditional sports. And while the investment goes in, the revenues haven't been able to grow in the same pace. So first of all, you're going to see a bunch of consolidation in that space. You're hopefully going to see some of the winning business models start to emerge. And you know, again, I think that's it's going to be quite interesting to watch. But I also think they're super tied in the sense that for you to have any successful esports, the core IP or the game that esports is based on has to be successful as well, right? It's in that sense they you know, esports is very closely tied to the product that, you know, people are competing in. If that makes sense.
By the way, totally makes sense. And you just mentioned Twitch. When you look at YouTube, a huge portion, remind me of the number, but a huge portion of the videos uploaded on YouTube are gaming videos. So YouTube is not a dancing cat platform anymore. It's not a news platform. It's not an entertainment platform the traditional way. It is a gaming platform. So how many percent of the videos uploaded on YouTube are gaming videos?
I don't know, but it's massive. Like it is absolutely massive. And in terms of different types of, so, you know, Twitch being live streaming, right, and YouTube being VODs, you know, there's a ton of value for games to have a strong presence on YouTube, right? Whether it's, you know, Fortnite or it's games like Minecraft, like the content creation is staggering. And again, it's another vector of which the gaming industry is growing in relevance, right? Because even if you aren't playing, you're watching somebody play or somebody made a piece of content that revolves around playing a game. I don't have the numbers in terms of what share of YouTube is game specific content.
Last question here, Paul. You're an economist by training. You study business administration at Aalborg University, and you made your master studies at Copenhagen Business School. And you worked for a consultant for Bain & Company. And then you picked the gaming industry. Probably, I mean, it looks like a very wise decision.
That's correct.
When you look forward, your own children, who do you think they should be working for? What would be the next big thing after gaming? Where would you love to see your children work for?
That is a great question that I have never been asked. I don't know. I would hope that they, you know, that switch, as you mentioned, career-wise, was driven by interest and passion, right? I hope that they are fortunate enough to be able to do the same. You know, so, you know, when our kids get put in that situation, a lot of things will have changed. And hopefully, you know, you and I have been able to keep up so we can actually act as counselors. But I hope that you know, they're able to pick something they're really, truly passionate about. And then with, you know, that will then grow into some substantial, right? Because that was my own starting point. I never joined gaming with the intent of or expectance of working on League of Legends or Fortnite, right? It was, I think, games are important. I think games are super interesting, you know, both from an entertainment, but also from a technology perspective, and would love to get my hands into that. So I guess that's a poor way to answer your question, but yeah.
But thanks anyways. And by the way, if we gave them advice, it's probably wrong. I remember my own grandfather, he was a mining engineer. He advised me strongly to go into mining because he says it's going to be coal mining, by the way. It's going to be one of the hottest industries in the future. Luckily, I didn't follow his advice. So maybe it's a counterindicator when we give our kids advice, isn't it?
Yeah, they should probably go and do the strict opposite.
Paul, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
And being part of this. It was very insightful, and good luck with everything you do.
Thank you. And you as well. Thank you for having me.
This was the Hive Podcast. My name is Christoph Kiese, and we hear each other next week. Thanks for listening.